You're listening to the Meet the Farmers podcast with me, Ben Eagle. To listen to previous episodes, visit thinkingcountry.com or find the podcast on iTunes by searching for Meet the Farmers. Hello everyone and welcome to the show. I'm in the car on my way up to go and see John Halsey today. John's an organic arable farmer and he also keeps sheep up in Suffolk near Bury St Edmunds. I've known about John for a few years, but this is actually the first time I've been to his farm, or will have been to his farm, so yeah, I'm excited to put some questions to him. Oh, I've just been put on a diversion. Now, I've been on some small roads, but this is taking the biscuit. Sorry, John, I think I'm going to be late.
Hello and welcome to episode 24 of Meet the Farmers, for which we're sticking in Suffolk, moving slightly west, this time towards Lavenham. Today's guest is organic arable and sheep farmer John Pawsey of Shimpling Park Farms, who farms around 650 hectares.
Our own farm's about 650, yes.
650 here, on clay soils. Cropping is diverse and includes organic wheat, beans and barley, as well as oats, spelt and... Now, I always say quinoa.
I always say quinoa.
But do you say quinoa?
No,
you say quinoa as well.
I say quinoa.
Good.
Say quinoa.
And quinoa. Amongst this, John runs nearly 1,000 breeding New Zealand Romney ewes, which graze on two-year grass and clover lays. The farm here is actively engaged in conservation work, with the Countryside Stewardship Scheme running until 2023. And John also invites school parties out to the farm and does evening walks for various special interest groups. John, I'm really pleased to be here, mainly because there are various people who are on my radar... who I want to visit, and you were definitely one of those. You're a fourth generation farmer. Tell me what the farm was like before you started here.
Well, I took over from my maternal grandfather, and his father was a Scot, came down in the 1880s, and you know they really were sort of pioneers, and I think he was seen as sort of quite a aspirational sort of farmer at the time when I took over, even though he was relatively old when I took over from him. But you know the farm was pretty traditional for a Suffolk heavy clayland farm with wheat and North Sea rape and sugar beet in the rotation. He was a great enthusiast for sugar beet and actually grew probably more than a lot of people who had an equally sort of the size of farm that he had. Because he had a lot of labour on the farm and he saw sugar beet as a crop for using up all the labour that he had.
And other than the organic conversion, of course, what are some of the changes, some of the larger, more significant changes that you've made during your period here?
I think that, you know, my grandfather definitely came from a generation of making... field sizes bigger. I mean, he took out a lot of hedgerows and was encouraged to do so. And, you know, I completely sort of empathise with the attitude towards food production in those days. During the time that I've been here, you know, farming's been through many changes. And we've certainly embraced most of those changes that we've had to make. Either we've been encouraged to by the government or financially we've been driven down certain routes. But definitely, I would say the biggest change has probably just been our sort of attitude to conservation on the farm. I think that's very different from when he was here.
Did you ever consider doing anything away from farming before you started, or have you always wanted to be a farmer?
Funnily enough, I never wanted to be a farmer. In fact, I was brought up in a town. My parents divorced when I was very young, and I lived with my mother in a town. And I think actually, in a funny kind of way, because I wasn't brought up on the farm, it allowed me to maybe, think out of the box a little bit more than if I had been brought up on the farm. No, I wanted to, I really love music, and I wanted to be an A&R man. I wanted to be spotting bands, yeah. I still do play music, but I don't make any money out of it.
Yeah. Tell me about this part of Suffolk.
We're on this bit of Suffolk, which is sort of relatively, people from sort of hillier areas of the country will laugh at this, but we're relatively high for Suffolk. In fact, I saw a map...
Compared to where I've just come from, this is positively hilly.
I saw one of those maps that you see in sort of a geography class when you're very young, this sort of raised map, and it had just where our farm is. It was called the East Anglian Heights, and it's sort of chalky boulder clay. It's where, you know, the glaciers, when they retreated, they dumped all this soil on top of this area. And it's actually a great soil. It's got a little bit of flint in there, which is good for sort of cracking and expanding and contracting soils. It holds its nutrients incredibly well. And actually, I think that, you know, when we first considered our organic conversion, we looked at, you know, where that might be more successful on various soil types. And certainly a hand slope series clay would be one way you would you would have at least a fighting chance of running a successful organic rotation.
Take me back to that period just before you made the decision to go organic. What were the conversations that you were having?
It was at a time, you know, when wheat was £75 a tonne, oilseed rape was £115 a tonne, and they were our sort of main crops, I suppose, apart from sugar beet. And we just weren't making any money out of farming. And I remember going, the buzzword, as it still is now, it was diversification. And I remember going to several meetings with my father looking at organic production. And at the time, you know, this was, you know, 1998, and the organic market was going up, I think it was 30% a year at the time. It was huge, the demand. And having a sort of a strong sort of conservation sort of bent as far as a direction I saw parts of the farm going in, I thought it sort of fitted nicely with that. So I was also incredibly lucky that just 5 miles away, there was a guy called Ben Pohl, who farmed at Horsted Place Farm. And he had maybe, I don't know, about 300 acres. And he had been farming it organically. His father started converting it in the 70s. And so I could go to his farm, I could see what it looked like and what it looked like after, you know, quite a few years of farming organically. I could say, Ben, what should I be budgeting for a ton of organic wheat and a sensible, you know, and he gave me this information. So it gave me, first of all, most people saying, you won't be able to do that on your farm. And here was somebody who quite obviously was doing it and was doing it successfully. So I really had something concrete to go on.
Did you have any concerns at the time? There must have been something going around your head, or was it, well, this is absolutely the right thing to do and we'll just deal with the issues as we go through them?
Definitely had concerns because, you know, most people were telling me all the reasons why it wasn't going to work on our soil. At the time, I was doing all the spraying on the farm, and I seemed to be absolutely wedded to the sprayer. And, you know, in those days, a fax would come through on a Friday from my agronomist who had been, you know, enjoying the sunshine, walking around my fields while I was locked in, hermetically sealed in a sprayer cab. And basically the fax would say, you know, you have to get all this done by the end of next week, otherwise, you know, don't bother getting your combine out. You know, it's sort of, and I just felt slightly out of control of my business. So even though I, you know, there were things that I thought, gosh, that's going to be difficult to overcome, I felt that I needed to change something. Also, the other thing is that when you are so incredibly busy and you don't have time to explore maybe some of the potential negative things you could be doing, and I'm not saying that I was doing them, but I also didn't have enough time to research what the cocktails of chemicals that I was putting on my soil were actually doing. Was there a lasting damage? Yeah. I don't know, and I don't know now. All I can tell you is that I was beginning to feel more and more uncomfortable about doing it.
We have featured organic arable farmers on the podcast before. Stephen Briggs is one.
Yes.
But we haven't really spoken about organic weed control methods.
Okay.
Which I'd like to go into a little bit. Can you talk us through some of the methods you use? Because there are still a lot of misconceptions out there, mechanical and otherwise.
So, yeah, that's a really interesting question. I had a student who rang me and wanted to interview me about weed control. And the first question was, what was your main form of weed control in an organic system? And the only answer is there is no one main form of weed control. You've just got to be getting everything right. And so it all starts with, you know, all the absolute basics that we all know and understand, but most people are driven by gross margins to avoid doing those things. So it's all about, you know, drilling date. It's not just drilling date from the beginning of the season to the end of one season, but it's drilling dates pre-Christmas and post-Christmas. It's about growing crops with a different architecture to smother weeds. It's about having a rotation that has you know, different crops with different, again, architecture, but the way that they also deal with weeds in an allelopathic way. And then, you know, when you've got, you know, you've done all that and you still have a problem, then you fall back on mechanical weeding. So that is the backstop. And it's an important backstop, but really, you know, if you're relying on mechanical weeding entirely, then you got it wrong.
We had some farming jargon in there for listeners who don't know. What does allelopathic mean?
Allelopathic is a chemical situation where the crop that you're growing, the plant that you're intending to harvest, is able to stop other weeds from germinating around it. And it's something that is inherent in nature, and it's how a lot of species that can be found in the world are able to grow away from the seedling stage by being able to prevent other seedlings from germinating around them.
There we are. We love farming jargon. You reintroduced stock to the farm relatively recently in 2014 when you bought your first lot of New Zealand Romney ewes, one of my favourite sheep breeds. You're lambing all outside with few inputs other than a bit of haylage and a bit of oats in the winter. Why the Romney, and why did you decide to integrate sheep in the rotation? And perhaps why sheep rather than cattle?
Okay, so I'll deal with the Romney first. We needed a breed that could lamb outside on its own without assistance, and something that was going to have, you know, good feet and a resistance to worms. And there were several breeds we looked at. We looked at the Clin, we looked at the Romney, and we also looked at the EasyCare. And actually, between the Clin and the Romney, it actually just came down to the fact that there were with a greater set of genetic breeding values for the Romney. So we felt that we could design our system more easily around that than what we felt we were going to get from the Clin. Also, the other thing is, and this is going to sound dreadful, but I just prefer the look of the Romney as well. And I would say that, you know, we pretty much do buy our rams off the spreadsheet. We don't, you know, look at them. But I have to say that even though we pick them off the spreadsheet, I then do go down and physically buy them and do have a look at them. Why sheep rather than cattle? Actually, I really wanted cattle. Cattle was what I thought I was going to... I just thought I wanted to see cattle around the farm rather than sheep. But then when I looked at the capital costs of starting back into livestock, not having had livestock on the farm since the sort of 1960s, is that the capital outlay for livestock was huge. Mm. So large bore water pipes going around our fields, large troughs, proper fencing, having to bale straw, then having to have a building to put the straw in, and then having to have a building to put the animals in over the winter. And sheep just seem like the obvious answer. They're all on electric fencing. We tow water bowsers around the fields for them, and we have a mobile yard. As far as capital costs are concerned, sheep were an obvious option. Ultimately, I suppose that to have a really good and productive, clean grazing system, you know, we would eventually get some cattle. But, you know, it's early days. Just watch the space.
And you're establishing... 2 year lays
yeah.
Temporary grass.
Yeah, we do 2 year lays. 2 years of temporary grass on our own farm, and on our contract farms, we're still actually on 1 year pretty clover dominated lays at the moment. And the intention is if the financials for the sheep sort of stack up on our own farm, we've got to look at it over a number of years. But we then might be able to expand that out onto our contract farms. But at the moment, we are sucking it and seeing. Mm. But in the future, hopefully, we'll be able to, you know, expand the flock and take it to our contract farms.
Did you consider having longer, say, 3-4 lays, or do the economics just not work? Were there other reasons?
I can't tell you that at the moment, because okay. We've only had sheep, and our first crop of lambs was in 2016, so I can't tell you that at the moment. But my gut feeling is that if we look at the gross margin we get from our sheep, and then you times that by where we should be when we get our flock to the size that we need it to be, and then we look at our capital costs, actually suddenly the sheep actually look pretty attractive. Mm-hmm. And so I can see us possibly going to 3 year lays. Okay. They're very expensive to establish, and when you've got a good lay, it's quite difficult to take it up after 2 years. But as I say, you know, we need to, you know, run the, you know, the figures for a number of years before we can feel confident about doing that.
The joys of farming economics.
It's important.
Yeah. Mm. You're farming pretty heavy clay soils here. Do the sheep have an impact in terms of compaction?
That is something that people said, you're going to get this lots of surface compaction. And, but actually I haven't noticed that. What tends to happen if you start digging our soils, now we've got 2-year lays, is that after 2 years, and especially after 3 years, and we have got some 3-year lays, is that, the soil really starts structuring itself, not just because the soil structures itself pretty well on Hanslope series clay by cracking, but also you develop a huge root mass. You also get lots and lots of deep burrowing worms. So I think that, that counteracts any surface compaction that the sheep do. But, this year, because it's been so dry, we probably run sheep on pastures longer than we would have liked. And some of those pastures we've taken up, ready for autumn drilling. And I have to say that they've just broken up beautifully. I haven't seen that as a problem, but that's not to say that it might be in the future.
I strongly recommend to listeners, if you haven't come across John's YouTube channel before, giving that a plug, certainly find him at John Fawzy on YouTube.
It's been an absolute revelation to me, that YouTube channel. And I started it because I bought the last bit of land off my family, and then I bought the last sort of shares out of the farming company from my family. And it was the first year that I was farming everything as my own. And I thought, I just want to make a video diary of it. Maybe. Yeah. And it was to show my children in sort of years to come. And then I, as soon as I started doing it, I thought, well, why not just put it on YouTube? Yeah. And I failed in one respect, as my children think it's the most boring thing they've ever seen in their lives. And it is. Some of them, my God, there's one in the grain store where I just don't even know where I put it up. It's so dull. But it's the conversation.
That's your definition of dullness.
But it's the conversation I love. And, I get all these comments from around the world, and I answer every single one, even the rude ones. And I just love it. And I've actually learnt so much from it. And that's what I love about YouTube, what I love about Twitter. It's about that knowledge exchange and social interaction between farmers from across the world. And it's just so incredibly important. I don't like the negative things. Mm-hmm. And I think there are some negative things about social media. And I don't engage with those. I'm very much... everything is from a sort of a positive bent rather than a negative one. And I think if you do that, there's so much to learn.
There is one particular video on your channel called, I think it's Moving Away from the Plough.
Yes.
This is again another misconception, which I've held as well, that if you're an organic arable farmer, you need to have a plough in your armoury. Hmm. Discuss.
Well, I mean, the plough is an important tool. There's no doubt about that. And we plough rotationally. So, before winter beans, because I want to drill them late, because I don't want them too plough before Christmas, and I don't want to give them any more chance of getting chocolate spot than they already, want to do.
You'll find, listeners, that John is fairly obsessed with chocolate spot.
I am absolutely obsessed with chocolate spot. And the plough allows us to weatherproof our soils to drill beans later on, nearer to Christmas. But, before we converted to organic, we didn't plough anything. And now, and then when we went to organic, we were encouraged to do more ploughing because it for better weed control. But actually, I think it's a myth, actually, because, we've got weed seeds throughout our ploughed profile, and so ploughing does nothing as far as reducing weeds are concerned on this farm, especially black grass. And I think it's about actually dealing with the weeds you've got nearer to the surface, doing all the things that I talked about before in a rotation to discourage any one weed from dominating. And also, we've just got a better hoeing system now, so we can deal with more weeds.
I want to talk about cultivations, and I want to talk about controlled traffic farming, but we'll probably do that outside. What do you get up to away from farming?
I play in a covers band, which is really great, and I also play in a folk band. I'm not a massive folk fan, but I play the double bass and the bass, and the thing about the folk thing is that mostly they demand acoustic, and so it's not lugging an amplifier around, and so
it's just lugging a double bass.
Well, the double bass, yeah, it is hollow. The other thing I absolutely love is walking, and I do a lot of walking with my wife. We usually try and walk first thing in the morning. So I usually go and see the guys on the farm at 7:30, and we immediately go for an hour's walk. And it just gets, everything out of the open. We discuss the day. Alice does various bits and pieces on the farm. We don't cross over in our jobs, otherwise we'd fight because we're very competitive. Okay. But Alice does, you know, deals with building lets and sort of various projects on the farm. And so there's lots to discuss as far as the business is concerned. And that's the time of the day we do it. And I just love walking. I love getting out there into the countryside.
Talking of walking, let's go for a walk.
Brilliant.
So we're actually finally standing in the field, which we should be really on this podcast. John, what's this field called? What's the size of it and what's happening in it currently?
This field is called a New Road Field. Part of the farm is on an old disused airfield, and this was the field that they put a bypass through. And you could probably, I don't know if you can just hear it, but
probably
there's
in the distance.
Quite a few lorries going up and down towards Berries and Evans, the sugar beet factory, just under 10 hectares. And we're currently drilling winter beans in the field, and we're looking down at the soil, and you can see some, actually most of them are sort of oat volunteers from last year's harvest, but there's also one or two black grass plants that we've pulled out. Now, even though we do very little ploughing on the farm, we do plough before winter beans because we need to weatherproof the soil so that we can drill later. We're drilling them as deep as we can. We try and get them into about sort of 3 inches deep, but again, it's quite difficult to get them in. We have to drill them because we want to hoe in between the rows. We don't plough them in.
What depth are your soils here?
So our topsoil is between 6 and 8 inches.
Talk me through your cultivation process. Obviously, yeah, this is a bit of a special case with your beans.
Yeah.
But your standard cultivations and how that's adapted as you've learned.
So our first pass is usually with it's a Grégoire Besson Discordon, which is I should be saying it probably with a much greater French accent.
I thought that was pretty good.
But anyway,
pretty good job.
It's a discs tines discs press sort of arrangement, and the reason why we like that is because it's a pretty solid bit of kit, and it really does mix the organic matter that we're growing up within our soil profile, but not like a plough that sort of puts it on the bottom of the furrow. It's thoroughly mixed within the soil profile, which makes it available to the crop that we're growing in the rooting zone, which is exactly where we want that organic matter. And then after that, we're really trying to make a little bit of a false seed bed with that, because we normally have to have one or two cultivation passes after that,
right,
to take out weeds that we want to germinate pre-drilling.
This seems to be a day of learning new terms, but I want really to talk about controlled traffic farming. Which you have been undertaking on the farm relatively recently?
Relatively recently. I mean, we're now, because we used to have a contractor who did our combining, but now we have our own combine. And the last bit in the sort of the chain was the combine harvester, and making sure the unloading auger dropped into the next door tram line where the combine was. And so that was the last link in the chain. One of the main reasons why we did it is because, you know, going back to diverse rotations, we really wanted to be 50% spring drilling. And on this soil, if you're leaving soils over winter, you know, they become very tender. And we were noticing, you know, a lot of yield loss, especially in spring crops from excess traffic. So that was a real driver to go down the controlled traffic route. And the best way to describe it, really,
yeah, I was going to say, because you'll do it much better. What's the John Pawsey definition?
Definition is that basically you've got to think in between your tram lines, they are just beds. They're like sort of vegetable beds that should never be run on. And so you keep your traffic very carefully defined into these tram lines, these traffic lanes, and you don't stray for them. It means that everything in between the traffic lanes never gets run on by anything. And so the soil is allowed to do naturally at depth what the soil does. We have had one or two issues, and that is actually with trying to take out our traffic lanes, because the difficulty is that every single tyre width is slightly different on the farm, and you end up by running on more soil than you really want to in the traffic lanes, and it makes drilling seed or sowing seed not more difficult. And so we need to come up with something. We're looking at an implement that we can put behind our the last pass of the primary cultivator to take out those traffic lanes, to make actually those traffic lanes more productive.
Do you think organic farmers are fundamentally better at being market-led? slash more experience, therefore
I think that's a really interesting question. It certainly made me like that. Okay. I mean, when we first converted, there was a company that were going around to all these little organic conversion talks saying, if you convert, we will buy everything you can produce. We just are desperate for it. And then 2 years later, after our conversion, rang up the same company and they just imported a whole load of wheat from the Ukraine. So I suddenly realised that actually selling organic produce was actually harder than selling conventional produce. So that's why we developed these different relationships with different buyers. So I don't know if all organic farmers are like that, but it certainly made us much more market aware.
So we're just going to have a bit of a talk about boys and girls' toys.
Yes.
Talk me through how your kit has changed over the years.
When I first came to the farm and took over my grandfather, we had 8 men on the farm and 13 tractors. And we had we would have a tractor that had a hedge cutter on it all the time, never came off. So in fact, just sat there for most of the year with the hedge cutter on, doing absolutely nothing. And so we've gone from 13 tractors farming 1,000 acres to 3 tractors farming 3,500 acres. And we've really just concentrated on, the equipment we need to do everything we need to do in an average year. So in a year like this year, which is not an average year, and actually the conditions have been very good, we will finish everything, in a timely way and with time to spare. In a poor year, we are probably under equipped, but that's not a problem. We just bring up local contractors and we get them in to help us out. And so I think the sort of, the core thing has been to just have enough machinery on the farm to deal with an average year. And it's just a constant, keeping a constant eye on our fixed costs to make sure that, we're still able to make some money out of farming.
Can you tell me about no-till farming in an organic capacity?
Yes.
Because the rhetoric that goes out generally is that no-till is really impossible still without glyphosate. Is that true?
In my opinion, I think at the moment, I think it is. And we've done a no-till trial on the farm, and very quickly, the trial was overcome by docks, creeping thistle, that sort of kind of thing. And I think glyphosate is incredibly important to be able to achieve a no-till system. Now, people are developing crimper rollers. They're looking at different kinds of cover crops to smother weeds and cover crops that also are able to be crimped and killed by a crimper roller. I think, we're going to struggle in a maritime climate, but it doesn't mean to say that it can't be done. At the moment, as far as our own business is concerned, I find the no-till route very attractive, but it's just too risky for me. Mm-hmm. At the moment, we have to develop a system which I believe is sustainable to our soils. Our organic matter started at 2.9% in 1999 when we converted, and it's now averaging about 5.5%. What tends to happen with a rotation with lays is you tend to build up a huge amount of worms in your lays, and gradually you do affect those populations when you're cultivating, but you still maintain a sustainable number of worms to keep the system going. I've slightly strayed from your question, but what I'm trying to describe is a system that actually isn't no-till, but it is still a system that looks after our soils. The other thing that I think that is interesting as far as organic systems and hoeing is concerned is that organic farmers are obviously are routinely accused of sort of doing damage to especially ground nesting birds. The difficulty is that when you're looking at a sort of a systems approach and you're looking at a system that actually favours farmland birds, and I would argue strongly that an organic farming system does because of the lays and the amount of overwinter stubbles we have, is that we have a higher population of farmland birds anyway. And actually we've done various surveys with the Suffolk Wildlife Trust to show that. And so even though we are into row hoeing and we do disturb nests, the fact is that we've got an increasing number of skylarks on the farm and other ground nesting birds. So I feel quite comfortable with that, to be honest.
So what's the future of the farm?
Gosh, I think it's a huge question. I don't think I've ever felt more excited about the future of this farm. I think that, you know, we are doing so many different things. Every day is a challenge. I think Brexit is going to sort us all out. I think there's going to be some big changes, and change is always exciting. As far as any of my children are concerned, one or two of them are starting to get interested in the farm, which is great. And so I just hope that I'm able to inspire them to look at the farm in a very different way than perhaps I looked at it when I first came, which was, you know, very much just down the growing crops route. I think there's going to be lots of different opportunities, and you've got to be open-minded to spot them. And I think, you know, it's going to be exciting.
I agree. John, thank you so much for letting me visit today. I've learned a lot from you. You've inspired me, and I wish you all the luck for the future.
Thank you so much.
The brilliantly inspiring John Pawsey, who you can find on Twitter at Hanslope, Hanslope. And do check him out on YouTube. Search for John Pawsey there to find his videos. I've got a busy couple of weeks podcast-wise. The next episode will be coming to you from the East of England Farming Conference, which I'll be covering. And then I have a trip to Wales. I'm doing a joint podcast with Matt Williams of the Wild Voices Project. We're visiting a National Trust farm in Snowdonia, which I'm very excited for. I've been Ben Eagle, and this has been Meet the Farmers. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram at Benji_Eagle. Benji is B-E-N-J-Y. I'll catch you soon.